Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Pet Professional Guild's monthly advocacy panel. My name is Don Hansen, and I am the chair of the advocacy division and also serve on the PPG board of directors, and I will be moderating today's panel. And I'm just going to call on each of my panelists here and let them give a brief introduction to themselves. And I'm going to just kind of follow around the screen. Your screen may look different, but I'm going to do it based on mine. Sam, you're up first.
Hi, my name is Sam Wyke. I'm a retired law enforcement explosive detection canine handler. I run my own business called The Inner Dog. And it's fun being part of this group. It's fun being part of the Pet Professional Guild because they're doing it right.
Excellent.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything retired about Sam. I don't know. I just have to say that.
Holden, you're next.
Hi, I'm Holden Spiersky. I am the chair of the Shelter and Rescue Division and a behavior consultant. My business is called Holden Canine.
Christy.
Hi, I'm Christy Benson, and I work for the Academy for Dog Trainers. And I think for the sort of relevance for today's topic, I was the director of the husbandry project that the Academy ran for a few years. So this is a topic that's sort of close to my heart and my professional work as well.
Beth.
Hi, I'm Beth Edelman. I'm a cat behavior consultant in New York City, and I'm on the executive committee of the feline group in PPG.
Excellent. And Tracy.
Tracy, you're on mute.
That's not good. My name is Tracy Hagan. I'm in Kentucky, actually. I'm on my own dog training business and behavior consulting. I'm also on the PPG Assistance Animal Division. And I'm also on the advocacy committee with Dawn. And I've been doing dog training for 16 years.
I just saw a white thing behind your shoulder. I thought it was a feather, and then I realized it's a dog's tail. It's so cute.
Yeah. He wants me to play fetch, and I refuse.
How dare you?
And Christina, you are next.
Hi, guys. I'm Christina Spalding. I have a PhD in biopsychology, and I'm a certified applied animal behaviorist. And I have a special interest in stress, which certainly comes into play when we're working with animals at vet clinics.
Excellent. Well, our question today is, what are the top 10 things we can do to help veterinarians help us to help our pets? And I thought I would start us off, and the first thing I would put on the list is to communicate. I believe it's essential that we develop and maintain professional communications with both our own pets veterinarians, but other veterinarians in our community. And by doing so, we can learn from them, they can learn from us, and that benefits everybody. So I would put at the first on the list, communicate, and I'll let any one of my fellow panelists jump in next, and they can either comment on that or add something else to the list.
Don.
Go ahead, Sam.
When you said about communicating, we have to remember where they're coming from, because at least I know in my area, most of the vets that I work with have never really had any kind of a background in behavior, training, anything else. So, you know, using the jargon and all that kind of stuff with them can actually create more of a barrier. Any ideas to sit down and say, listen, you know, what do you see? Here's what I see, and how can we help each other? But, you know, again, and a lot of vets, and ones I've worked with over the years, don't have the most positive view of many trainers because of how they present themselves. And so we've got to be able to go in there humble and be reasonable.
Sounds good. Who would like to go next?
Go ahead, Nikki.
I learned a long time ago, actually, not to tell the vet that I'm a dog trainer. And I know that sounds bizarre, but I found that I got a better reception. And I tested this because I move a lot. So I had access to a lot of veterinarians. And some of you may recall a few weeks ago, I put a post on Facebook because I was actually thrown out of the veterinary office. And I think there were a lot of things that contributed. I think something had happened with the vet earlier, and I've actually found out since that it had. So I don't think they came at the conversation as they would have normally done. But even with that particular hospital, a lot of people said to me, well, didn't they know who you were? Well, first of all, who I am isn't irrelevant, and that wouldn't mean anything to a veterinarian. But I've often found that just by going in as a pet owner and being polite and being courteous and developing a relationship then puts me in good stead later on to say, oh, by the way, I'm a dog trainer. Can we talk about A, B, C, or D? Because what Sam said, that a lot of vets do not have or have not had good exposure. They don't have a reinforcement history with a lot of pet professionals. So therefore, when you start off by saying I'm a dog trainer, they immediately are, they sort of sense that secondhand car salesman type scenario where you're about to ask them to show your brochures or refer clients or give things out. So again, I mean, I found that just going in as a very polite, courteous, caring pet owner, and then once there's a little bit of a relationship, then talking about who I am and what I do has been easier for me to approach them from their perspective and being able to sort of be more receptive to what I'm asking or recommending.
Christina.
Yeah, I was going to ask if we were talking about helping vets from the perspective of a pet caretaker or a professional, but it sounds like we're at least doing professionals. I don't know if we're talking about things that guardians can also do to help their vets out or just all of it. But one of the things that I found really helped me was to go in and give presentations on behavior to the staff for free. And that was very, very beneficial and really allowed the vets to get to know who I was and allowed me to get to know them. And through that, I was better able to advocate for the animals that I'm working with because I was able to develop a relationship of trust with several different veterinarians in the area. And when, I mean, I'm sure this is not just me, but in my experience, you know, when we can bring the vet on board and we can have that team working for the dog, that the outcomes are very frequently better, or the cat or whatever species it is that we're working with.
Do you think, Christina, that you may have an easier job getting through the door because you can use PhD or doctor?
I mean, probably. I mean, I hate to say that, but yeah. And I think part of it is, as you guys were saying, is that a lot of vets have had bad experience with trainers because there's a wide variety of skill levels out there, right? And so there's tons of trainers and behavior consultants that don't have PhDs that are phenomenal, but at least if the vet knows nothing else about me, because they know what a PhD is, right? They don't know what a lot of the other certifications are.
Right.
So yes, I mean, I suspect that that does help, but I certainly wouldn't. I mean, I would still encourage people that don't have
I just think it might, because I have to sort of go around it in a bit of a clandestine manner. But once I'm in, I get invited for lunch and learns, and I have a really nice vet pack that I have with all kinds of flyers and information in, to the point where I've actually hosted several dog training classes at veterinary clinics.
Right.
But it's taken, wherever I've moved with my business, it's taken me a year to get to that point. And possibly if you are credentialed or they understand credentials, it may expedite that sort of transition.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think one of the ways to approach it is we have to educate them in a manner which it's going to make it easy for them to take in what we're trying to teach them. And that includes teaching them about credentialing and things, because as Sam noted, that most veterinarians don't get a lot of behavioral training, if any at all, in vet school. And they may come in with some preconceived notions, and we just have to be as patient and as reinforcing with them as we would one of our paying students. And I've learned over the years, if you do that, it can work really, really well. And Christina, you had asked, you know, are we talking about just professional or helping vets help our clients? I think we're covering both. I think we really need to talk about both. So
how many, let me just take a quick poll. How many of you on the panel work with a veterinarian that will actively refer their clients to you? Just put your hand in the air. Okay, how many of you have more than one veterinarian office referring clients to you? Okay, and another quick question. On 1 to 3 years to build up that relationship, how many of you got to that point within a year of being in your area? All right, what about 2 years? Yeah, so I think, because one of the things that we talk about in marketing is that a vet's like a referral partner, aren't they? And you wouldn't refer another vendor, nor would you expect someone to refer you if they don't understand you, know you, and have a reinforcement history with you. So I think as dog trainers, we often try to walk into a vet's office and give business cards and say, can you please display these? And there's absolutely no reason why they should do that, nor would you in your business. I think we have to accept that building that referral takes time and an investment of caring about them and working with them, rather than expecting them to do things for us straight away.
Tracy, go ahead.
So what I did in my area to build a relationship, obviously I had a relationship with my personal vet that I take my dogs to already. But what I did was I went to all of the, actually I did vets, offices, groomers, they like boarding type places, daycares, stuff like that. And just asked them if they would mind if I put a free flyer every month in their lobby. I took the stand and I would change them out myself. They wouldn't have to do anything. And it would just be free information for their clients or patients. And I put it in the waiting area of all of them. And after, I would go in the first of every month and put in the next month's new flyer. And it was on training, like how to train loose leash walking, how to train, or how to work with barking, how to, do different things. And every month it was a different thing. And so every month when I would go in, I would be talking to the staff and talking to one or two of the vets would be walking around and I would talk to them. And so I build up my trust, I guess, with them by doing that, by giving them free information for their clients. And I didn't ask for anything in return. I didn't ask them to hand out my card or anything. And now I have vets that refer to me that I've never met.
Exactly. Yeah.
I think the other thing, first of all, I want to hit on the idea of, people need to be patient. You do have to build up a relationship, just like we have to do with the dog, another person, and that takes time. And if you're new in the area, it may take more time. But the other thing I think is equally important as developing that relationship with the vet is developing a relationship with the gatekeepers. And that's often the business manager or even below the business manager, the receptionist.
Yeah.
If you make friends with all the receptionists, and I'll tell you, donuts and baked goods and apples and fresh fruit, it may sound silly, but reinforcement works and luring works. And that's really more luring than anything else. But it's worth making an investment in that.
Yeah. And I'm just going to answer a question that came off Facebook. A question from Julie, is the education of certification something PPG as an organization could create a program for? Julie, I'm not really sure I understand that part of the question. So could you just give me a little bit more? But then she goes on to talk about marketing materials. And just so you know, Judy Luther and I with the K9 division are actually working right now on putting together a comprehensive veterinarian pack for members to use, which includes the article Linda Michaels wrote on socialization and vaccinations go together, the importance of socialization, the questions you need to ask before you refer a dog trainer, so that the members can brand it with their own logos. And it's something that you can either use as individual handouts or you can take in as a comprehensive pack, because that type of thing has certainly worked for me in the past. So that certainly works. The second part of that question, I think I'm going to hedge a bet and ask, I think it's about, can we take on a role to educate about credentials? That's a really difficult one. Because there are credentials and there are credentials, and I don't think it's our role to judge or make comments about credentials. I think what we can do, what we could do, what we're looking at doing is putting a matrix together of industry credentials and identifying those that are independently assessed, those that come with ethics, those that are done through independent examination companies, those that are just sort of pay and play. I think we can do that because we can keep it objective and very factual. But other than that, there isn't really anything else that we can say about credentials because I don't really think it would be our role to do that. I don't know if anyone wants to add. Beth, you were going to say something. I don't know if you want to.
Yeah, I was actually going to address the initial topic of, you know, what can we do, you know, to help veterinarians help us. And I had something to say about that pertaining to veterinarians working with us and something about pertaining to us working with clients and veterinarians. So I think the number one thing we can do is to be professional. And I think that that works in two ways. One is to be professional with the veterinarian. And that means professional and respectful in all of our conversations with them. And one of the things that I do when I get a referral from a veterinarian is I always send a follow-up. I always, because if that veterinarian were to refer to me and I was, let's say, a veterinary cardiologist, I would always send a follow-up. You know, if I were another veterinary professional, I would always send a follow-up report. And I'm an animal professional. And so I always send a follow-up. When I get a referral from a veterinarian, I always send a follow-up. Thank you for referring Bob and Susan and Fluffy to me. I saw them on June 23rd for the problem of eliminating outside the litter box. I gave them a program which included, and they get like four bullet points. They don't get the big summary of the whole program because nobody has time to read that. I gave them a program which included blah, 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 and I'll be following up with them. Thank you again. So that's the way in which I'm professional with the veterinarian, is that I act myself as another specialist, because I'm the behavior specialist.
Absolutely.
I think we can also be professional when we talk about veterinarians with our clients. And one of the things that happens when I go to see clients is that I often see things about the way the cat is moving that suggest there might be a physical problem. And I typically insist, especially with litter box and aggression, that they visit the veterinarian before they see me. And sometimes I'll go and I'll see a cat walking around or jumping here and there, and I'll say, your cat is limping in the back. Have you addressed that with your veterinarian? And they'll like be like, he went to the veterinarian 2 weeks ago, the vet didn't say anything about that. And because I want to be professional about the veterinarian, I say, well, you know, I'll bet your cat didn't walk around in the veterinarian's office. So I have a unique vantage point. I can see him walking around in your house. My guess is your cat just sat on the table and did this. And they go, yeah, that's right. And I was like, so there's no way your veterinarian could have seen that. So let's take a video and let's send it to your veterinarian and say, hey, Fluffy's having this litter box problem. And I know you did this other workup, but gosh, the behaviorist noticed that he's limping. Let's take a look at this video. Do you want me to bring him in again? Can we address this? So I always try, when I'm talking to the client about the veterinarian, even if I feel like the veterinarian has not done a thorough workup or has given them bad advice, I always speak as another professional speaking about another professional. I never just say, oh, your veterinarian doesn't know anything about cats, you know, or anything like that. I always make sure that I speak about other professionals in a professional way.
All really, really excellent points. I mean, it's important to keep that line of communication open and recognize that we're working together as a team.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things I was hoping to sort of get across in this panel too is that I think there's a lot of people have kind of, not a confrontational relationship with their vet, but a lot of my clients have sort of, I think they sort of come in feeling like the vet's there to fleece them or something, you know. Well, and this may be, I don't know if this is particularly in Canada because we have like universal healthcare. So we don't understand how much healthcare actually costs, but someone will go into the vet and just be really, you know, they feel kind of upset about the bills and they feel like, oh, they're just trying to get all these tests. And so I feel like it's part of my role because, you know, I feel like I have a better understanding of really how hard it is to be a veterinarian. You know, I'm friends with a lot of veterinarians. I see how absolutely difficult it is for them to do their jobs effectively in the face of that kind of pushback. So I try to be very I try to myself push back against it a little bit when I can with my clients. So if they were talking about a medical referral, or if we're talking about behavioral meds that might be sort of useful for this dog, I try to sort of get it across that, you know, they're going to be going in and speaking to someone is in a difficult position just by how the world works for veterinarians, right? And I try to make sure that, you know, if I can, I sneak in messages just about, you know, we can be kind to our vets, and our vets, you know, will really appreciate us having that sort of come, instead of coming and being like, I know you're going to try to sell me something that I don't need. Instead being like, you know what, I really care about my animal, and I know you do too. And let's see if we can sort of come to, you know, maybe I can't afford the best, but maybe I can afford something that will really improve my animal's welfare and behavioral health kind of thing. So I think that I do try and get that messaging across. And I think it's part of being a good team member. I mean, yes, dog trainers have it really hard too. We're dealing with a lot of stuff, you know, even from our colleagues that sort of is like a big driver for burnout. But I feel like veterinarians too have a lot of burnout. And if we can do our part, then, you know, I think that's effective, and it'll end up helping dogs too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I agree, Christine. I think as well, I don't think a lot of people realize, but a lot of vets have their own minimum care standard of care philosophy. So, and they can be quite different across different practices. And I think sometimes there is areas for, I hate to use the word negotiation, but that's what in fact what it is. There are areas for negotiation with vets. And I think a lot of vets are amenable to that if you approach them properly, rather than just assuming that what they're doing is maybe not accurate or over medicating or whatever. So I think there's always the ability to work with them as well.
You know, Christy, you brought up a good point, and I kind of want to steer us down another little channel here. The COVID has been hard on all of us, but it has been especially hard on the veterinary community. I wrote an article about this last summer about the number of vets choosing to go out of business, the shortage of vets, shortage of vet technicians. And it really hasn't gotten any better. So I'm curious, how have you seen things change in your communities, both looking at pre-COVID and post-COVID? Because I know it's had a dramatic effect on all of us here in New England.
Hey Don, I know with the veterinary hospitals in my area, something I have never seen in 25 years living here, is that two of the major hospitals have actually gone to what they call a pause from 6 at night till 6 in the morning, unless it's an actual life-threatening emergency. You don't even think about taking whatever animal you have to them, because they don't have the staff or the resources to deal with it. And then on the local side with the small vets, I'm seeing, you know, clients are telling me they're trying to get appointments just for simple things, annuals and vaccinations and that. And they're talking anywhere from 3 to 6 months down the road before they can get in. But on the emergency side, and some friends of mine that are vet techs, not only did they have vets leave, but they've had vet techs leave as well. And so it seems that within the entire industry, there is such a shortage. And they're telling me there's just no end in sight. They actually are predicting it to get worse instead of better.
How about the rest of you?
I think to compound a lot of the problems that were there already, or the challenges, we've also got a sort of nationwide supply chain, staffing, recruitment, which certainly doesn't help. And I don't think we can forget as well, I mean, veterinarians as professionals are one of the lowest paid professionals given the level of education they receive. And many of them come out of school with student debts that will literally take 20 years to pay off. So I think there's something that upsets me more when people talk about veterinarians are just in it for the money. I don't know why anybody would work in that industry just for the money. I don't think there's enough money to get people into that industry unless you have a massive amount of passion for the welfare of animals. So and I know that veterinarians are open to a lot of abuse, because they are often directly in front of the client, who is also emotionally charged. They get a lot of when I spoke to my new vet recently, she told me that so much of what they do is conflict resolution and management within the treatment room, which is the last thing they need to be doing. They should be looking after the welfare of the animal. But, you know, that's sort of the role that they find themselves in now.
Holden.
Yeah, I'm so glad that we're talking about this. And, you know, certainly there's been the campaign of Not One More Vet that I think we all need to be aware of, because burnout is a huge issue in the veterinary community. I think I feel really lucky in that my career started working directly underneath veterinarians. So I started my shelter and rescue work at a clinic that was also a shelter, also worked at the San Francisco SPCA, and got to work underneath Dr. Janine Berger. So I've seen in my day-to-day work how many extra hours these veterinarians put in, how they will stay long after closing for no pay, doing everything extra that they can. And I see the toll that it's taken on people who I consider at this point in my career to be my friends. It's difficult. And so, yeah, I agree with what was said earlier that, you know, what I think our job as behavior pros and trainers and behavior consultants is to inspire empathy in our clients and prepare them to have conversations that are grateful and respectful, not just of the profession in general, the veterinary profession, but also, yeah, of their time. So, you know, some practical things that I will do, I certainly, and especially as a certified separation anxiety trainer, I'm doing data collection and condensing that data into relevant charts and graphs so that, you know, for the veterinarians that I send behavior reports to, they can really look and within a minute see what progress looks like. I'll ask specific questions. I want to actually thank Dr. Elise Christensen for her recent webinar that was given about a month ago on medication. She included some really great specific questions for behavior professionals to ask of vets in their referral letters and reports. Those have been helpful to me just in the past month. Video collection, I absolutely agree with, because, you know, speaking with the COVID changes, sometimes the guardians aren't even really able to get a lot of face-to-face time with the veterinarians. You know, they may have to wait outside. So, you know, short video clips preparing ahead of time with, you know, succinct reports so that those conversations can be as quick and effective as possible. All of that, I think, is work that we can take on to make everything go a lot more smoothly with the actual conversation between my client, so to say, and the actual veterinarian. It's hard. And it's particularly hard right now. There are a few things that have been in the news recently that are absolutely heartbreaking. So I think every chance that we can get to express our deep gratitude for the work that these veterinarians do, because they're just going above and beyond all the time, every day of their work.
Absolutely. I mean, maybe what we should do, Dr. Lisa Rodosta is coming on in August to talk about this same topic. She actually has joined the advocacy panel, but couldn't be here today. But I think one of the things we should probably do is sort of look at a list of the key behaviors that pet owners should know. I mean, I know that we should be building collaborative care into our sessions, shouldn't we? So that the basics are already there for people who go into the vet's office. Because, and maybe we need to put a list together of the recommended skills as part of that vet pack. So that, because Holden's absolutely right. I think as professionals in our industry, we have an obligation when we're working with our pet owners to set them up for success. We work on skills for the home, but the veterinarian office is a really important location and one that the dog is going to be going to all its life, at least once a year, if not twice. So I think there is a big obligation there as well. And Holden, to your point, I mean, several years ago, we owned a veterinary hospital, and I used to watch Jennifer Stovey, who was the vet that was on board. I mean, she would come in on a Sunday just to, because somebody would have found a turtle on the road that had been run over, and she would leave her family and go to the clinic to help rehabilitate a turtle. I mean, they do an amazing job.
I have countless stories of shelter clinics where we have to push them out the door.
And not just the vets, but the vet techs, the nurses, the front desk staff. I mean, they do work super, super, super hard. And again, it's a very emotionally charged industry. I have to tell you, it's not a job I could do. I couldn't be around animals that were in pain like that. It would mentally destroy me, emotionally destroy me. So it is, it's a really hard job.
I think one of the things that we can also just consider doing, I know we all have a lot of advocacy sort of orient, you know, stuff on our shoulders already. But because there's such, I think that the issue with vets is compounded by the lack of vets, you know, there's not enough vets, there's not enough vet techs, that I try and aim some of my advocacy beam at this issue. Like in my province of British Columbia, there's just not enough spots in universities to train vets. And this is something that a lot of people are working on and taking it to the provincial government and trying to get more seats, you know, so we can get more people trained. And I think, I think that is like one of the, you know, take a step back and really sort of say, well, this isn't going to help in the next 1 year, but this is something that will make the industry sort of more healthy and sustainable and make it easier for vets to do their job and stuff in the future.
Yeah. And just so you guys know, I'm making notes from here. And what I'm hoping I can do from this is to extract 10 tips for pet owners that we can build into a handout. So while you're sort of thinking about what Don's asking you, have a think so that at the very end, we can do around the room and sort of what's the top one tip that you would give a pet owner to helping prepare their pet or prepare themselves for the vet so that that helps the vet to help them. And hopefully we can get a nice educational piece out of this.
I'm going to throw one out there right away. This is something I've been teaching my puppy students forever, is that during the socialization period, they want to build up a bank account of a lot of happy vet visits. And this isn't an appointment where they're actually going to go in and see the vet. It's just they're going to show up, wait till one of the receptionists has a moment, ask the receptionist to give a dog a treat and leave. No exams, no poking, prodding, but just lots of trips there so we can build up a positive association. And during COVID, what I was telling to people do, because in most cases, the pets were the only ones allowed in the facility, and we keep going back and forth on that with veterinary clinics here, is if nothing else, go and sit in the parking lot and feed your dog some treats. They know when they're different places. They really, really do. I've got clients who tell me all the time when they're bringing their dogs to us that they get all excited and happy, you know, mile before they get here. And that to me just, that makes me feel real good. But we want them to feel good about going to the vet too. And the vets love me telling people to do this, because if they can work on animals who aren't afraid to be there, they're less risk to their staff, less risk to themselves, and the animals are in a much better place. And that, I think, is one place we can start.
Yeah. And I think another thing kind of going along with that is to talk to your vets about if you're not already, or if they're not already becoming fear-free certified. And if they are, make sure they understand how much it's appreciated. And I switched in the middle of, well, not the middle of COVID, but at the beginning of COVID when we couldn't bring our animals in. I mean, I have a dog that he's got a lot of issues, and I changed to a fear-free vet because there was no way I was sending him into a clinic that wasn't fear-free without me.
Yeah.
And it has been...
It's a life changer, isn't it?
It has been life changing.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, he was there on Monday, and we got a blood draw from him, and they clipped his nails. I mean, he was on meds, but like, it was fine. She couldn't get his temperature, but she let that go, and that was fine. And so I think I'm so grateful for that movement. And of course, I think some vets fully embrace it. I mean, we're incredibly lucky that we have this clinic because she left her previous job and built a new clinic from scratch that was totally fear-free. So some vets embrace it much more than others, but I think what I've been telling clients is if their vet is not already doing that, that they need to talk to them about how much that is important to them and how much it means to them, because it makes a huge difference for everybody.
Oh, I mean, Christina, that veterinarian office that I was removed from because I was really a little bit concerned, and I was very polite about how they were rough handling my dog, who then picked my record up and said, get out, it's fine. I went to a vet about 4 miles around the corner that I did not know was fur-free certified, and I went in there and had an entirely different experience. And it wasn't until I went to check out that I saw a little fur-free sticker on the lovely marketing pack they gave me. And when I asked them if they were a fur-free hospital, they said, we can't advertise that because not all of us are, but our owner is, and he trains us every day.
Yeah.
So even if the facility is not fear-free certified, if somebody in the facility is, it's probably by osmosis moving into all the different treatment rooms. Yeah. But I was amazed by the difference in that. And I have another question from Facebook, which is in line with this sort of fear-free movement. And I think I know the answer to this. I'm not sure. So somebody else jump in. The question is there any data collection going on within fear-free veterinary program which will show benefits to business practice? I think I read somewhere that there were some stats produced and it showed something like a 20% increase in income year over year. So I know that there is some data being collected because fundamentally, most people will resist doing something unless that there is something in it for them. It's a hard sell, isn't it? Change is always a hard sell. So I do think there is some, there are some resources. Is anybody more familiar with that?
So I'm fear-free certified trainer. And so on the fear-free website, I mean, they have like seminars or whatever for practices showing them how, you know, so because most vets look at it as it takes more time,
right,
give the dog more time to whatever, and I'm going to lose money and whatever. And they have seminars and webinars and stuff about that on their practice for the practices that that talk about, you know, that it's really, it'll actually raise your income.
Yeah. And,
you know, and it gives all the benefits of, you know, how it can help the practice itself. Yeah. And I'm sure that they probably have the statistics on their website somewhere.
I know that I saw a report somewhere. I was also fear-free certified, but I let it go because I don't do a lot of training anymore, but I did see something flash over my computer screen. So I'll try and find that if I can.
And just, if I can just add one more thing to that is I think from a consumer perspective, once people get a taste of this and they figure it out, they're not going to go back. Right. If you are at a truly fear-free clinic and you switch to another clinic because you move or for whatever reason, and those staff there are going back to manhandling your dog, I mean, I just don't think people are going to tolerate it.
Yeah.
I mean, the vast majority. So that's my prediction, is that it's going to become a big sea change because it's going to start to come from the consumers as a demand.
Yeah,
no, I think you are 100% correct. We started using a vet long before fear-free existed. And we have followed him to three different practices because he's been practicing that philosophy since day one. The dog or cat does not go up on the table. You know, you come in, he's sitting on the floor, the animal's on the floor, 5-10 minutes later, then the exam starts.
I've always believed, Don, we've had conversations for years about our advocacy, and that we've always believed that the most important advocacy we can do is educating pet owners, because it's only when pet owners start to make demands of professionals that things are really going to change.
So I just to add to that, Christina, I had a similar experience to you. I changed veterinarians during COVID because the vet practice that I've been going to for years, where I loved my veterinarian, but I always felt like the veterinary technicians were rough with my cat. And I would always be in the office and just say, my cats are trained. You don't need to handle them that way. Don't scruff my cat. You know, I mean, I was always there. That veterinarian moved out of state. And so I said, okay, this veterinarian who I love is no longer there. There's no reason for me to continue going to this practice.
Yep.
And there was practice that had opened actually closer to my house, new practice in which everyone is fear-free. And I went there and looked around, and they had, so first thing, separate exam rooms for dogs and cats.
Yeah.
The cat exam rooms have scratching posts and shelves on them.
Yeah.
And feel away. And they never smell like dogs because there's no dogs there ever. Yeah. Okay. I brought my cat there. It was a totally different experience for me. I didn't have to keep saying to people, don't touch my cat that way. Don't handle my cat that way.
Yeah.
It was a whole different experience. So I did a couple of things. The first thing I did was I went on Yelp and Google reviews and the neighborhood review site and all of those things and gave them a great review and explained exactly why, not just this is a great vet, but this is a great vet because I gave them a good review on all of those websites that people look at, you know, so that it would be out there. And then, I mean, my clients ask me all the time, I don't like my vet. Do you like a vet? I never try to push someone away from their vet. But if someone says to me, I'm not crazy about my vet, then I can say, well, you know what? I am crazy about mine.
Yeah.
And here's where they are. I never, never try to take someone away from their veterinarian. But if they ask me, I will answer. You know, and so here's mine, here's why I'm crazy about them, here's what I like. If you're looking for a new vet, you know, just be sure to look and see that they're fear-free certified, and here's why this is important. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I think we can advocate in that way without sort of, you know, saying to a client, oh, if your vet's not fear-free, don't go there. But when they bring it up, you know, or if they say, hey, you know what, my cat always freaks out at the vet, one of the things that you can say is, well, you know, sometimes when you go to a fear-free vet, they move more slowly, they're more considerate. That can help if your cat is very anxious and nervous at the vet, you know, that kind of thing. And it's a way to do it without just sort of saying your vet's never good, which I don't want to say because that goes back to what I said before about being professional with other professionals.
I think one way we can do it is by giving them some key descriptions of what to look for in a veterinary visit.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm a big supporter of fear-free, but I also want to point out, I know we have some vets in our area that have chosen not to go down that road, but have followed Dr. Sally Foote's program, which is also very, very good and really is reaching the same objective, different way to get there, but there are multiple ways to get there. So I really like the idea of trying to tell people what to look for in a vet. And I think that can help them a lot. And I like your idea, Beth. Well, I'm crazy about my vet, and this is why. That's another great way to approach it.
I think that's a really good point, Don. And I think we need to be very cognizant of that when we make marketing materials, that we don't just sort of use the fear-free certification, because you're right, there are. And there are also some veterinarians that don't do either, that are also really good veterinarians and practice sort of force-free handling. So we probably should make a list of, we have some great, I mean, do you remember the Dr. Anderson questions about the 10 questions that you should be, that your vet should be asking you about your puppy? We should probably do something like that, the 10 questions that we should be asking the vet, you know, in terms of their philosophy, so that we don't just rule out veterinarians that don't buy into those programs, because some, for obviously personal choices, don't.
Right. I mean, it's simple things. You know, the vet I used to go to, when I bring my cat there, you know, a cat is examined on a table, and the table is stainless steel. And every single time, 100% of the time when I got there, I'd have to say to them, please put a towel on the table. You know, why do I have to remind you that? The new vet I went to, I got there, and there was a rubber mat with a towel over it already on the table when I got there.
Holden.
Yeah, just getting back to sort of, you know, our responsibilities versus, you know, putting things onto the client or asking questions of veterinarians. One thing I really love, and Christy can probably speak more to this, about the husbandry project is that it aims through desensitization and counter conditioning to prepare dogs for more invasive restraint. Yeah. And I've used those plans to, you know, prepare a dog, even if the practice isn't fear-free, right? Even if they're not necessarily using low stress handling techniques, that my client's dog will be prepared for more invasive restraint because we've gone through these systematic programs.
Yeah. You know, it's, at PPG, we consider that so important now that we're actually reviewing some of the skill requirements for the PPAB credentials, and we're actually going to build into those some collaborative care skills. Because that is such an important part of what we do now, isn't it? It's not just pet manners, it's also preparing animals for those types of situations, for being, for handling and stuff. So,
you know, another one to add to your list, Nikki, and something I'm telling my puppy students is prepare your dog to wear an Elizabethan collar before they ever have to wear one.
Oh, Louise Appleton-Rappel, my partner at Dognostics, did a great paper on this. and actually interviewed several vets on it, and that statistics do show that stress reduces healing time. So if you have a dog that's going into the vet that's having any kind of surgery and they need to wear an Elizabethan collar, all vets should be prepared, all owners should be prepared for that. Because if your dog will comfortably wear one after surgery, their healing time is reduced.
I agree. I think, like, because we're trainers here, the training component, we can't ignore. And I think there's like two big ways that we as trainers can really sort of help vets and help dogs. Number one is if you're lucky enough to teach a puppy class or have a puppy, is to get them really ready and not just like one or two things. Like, I think if you're teaching a puppy class, take a big chunk of time. The dogs can learn to sit when they're juveniles.
Yeah.
If you have socialization aid puppies, let's get them comfortable with stethoscopes and scrubs and the smell of the vet and restraint, all sorts of restraint, being lifted onto a table. Even if you don't think that your vet lifts dogs onto tables, you go on a vacation somewhere close to where I live right now, they will be lifted onto a table. So like, I think we can do all of this with puppies and just get them comfortable right from the get-go. Exams, looking in ears, looking at teeth, all of this stuff. We know what vets do, you know? So if we have a chance to get our puppies pre-comfortable, let's do it. And then the next one is something that Holden brought up, is husbandry training. And the Academy did a big like multi-year project where we tested out training plans. And we tested out, I don't know, something like 25 different training plans with the public and professional trainers. And we ended up with like these awesome vetted plans that are just, I mean, they're superb. There's DRI plans, so stationing plans to get dogs comfortable standing to have, and then there's CER plans to create positive conditioned emotional responses to, you know, vet staff and contexts and items. And they're all of this is for free, available. You know, there's a how-to document and then there's all the plans, and anyone can download them. Any vet practice can download them and hand them out. Any dog trainer can download them and use them in their own practice. So I think having quality, and Holden put a link in the chat there, but having, so coming at this, like the professionals that we are, and saying, we're going to use vetted plans to get our dogs comfortable and sort of with a positive conditioned emotional response, whether that's like the direct result of the plan or a side effect of just good positive reinforcement training, to go to the vet, to go into the vet room, to stand for this thing, you know, with a wagging tail. Imagine how good it would feel to be a vet, to not have to like manhandle this dog, because the dog's like, I got this, I've done this 500 times before. So I think that the puppy thing and then the training adults with good plans is a way that we can really contribute as well.
Absolutely.
Christina, you've been waiting so patiently.
Yeah. So I think all of the information about husbandry and cooperative care is really wonderful and great, and the socialization. And I wanted to go back to something that Nikki said about healing and stress and the relationship between physical health and emotional health is very, very close, and they're really not two different things. And so when animals are experiencing high levels of stress, it does impact their body. It does impact their health. There have been studies in humans that have been done where if they look at this wide range of different biomarkers that are impacted by stress, they can predict heart disease, they can predict death, they can predict cognitive decline. This is a very, very real thing. And I think a lot of, I'm not sure there's enough understanding about this, you know, in the vet world and just all around in general. And so one thing that I think we can do to advocate for our animals better, or to help vets advocate for our animals better, is I would love to see, so now in human clinics, it is not uncommon for people to go in to see their medical doctor, their primary care, and get a little questionnaire about their mental health. And this is something that trainers and veterinarians could work on together to develop a very basic questionnaire that the vet could administer to their clients that takes 5 minutes or less, or people could even fill it out, you know, when they're waiting to see the vet, and then providing information to the vet clinic about these are the flags, and you could give people handouts, and when do you refer, so that this would have a benefit, right, of hopefully getting animals into behavior practices sooner when they're just starting to have issues instead of when they're, you know, they've already bitten multiple times, and increasing health of the animals and well-being overall, because if they are experiencing stress and that's going untreated for a long period of time, it's going to contribute to additional behavior or health issues. So I would love to see some kind of movement like that in the animal world, where we're having that back and forth between behavior consultants and veterinarians in terms of that intersection between behavior, stress, and health.
Christina, I think you really brought up a really great topic, and I can't wait until we do the session talking about animal emotions.
Yes.
That is scheduled here, because I remember it was probably, well, I've been doing this for not quite 27 years yet, so it was probably about 26 years ago, and the vet, who is recently new out of vet school, telling me animals don't have emotions. And I just kind of walked away dumbfounded. And
Chris, you and I are doing a Facebook Live very soon about stress, aren't we? And because Christina has a workshop coming up on stress through her business, and she's also doing a webinar for PPG, I think, on stress as well.
Yes, that already happened.
Okay, well, there you
go. I do have a class coming up on emotions.
Yeah.
Yes.
But I think what I really want to hit on what you said is how many vets know and understand this. And I think my guess is it's not taught in vet school. I don't know that, but I suspect it isn't.
I just have two points I want to make quickly. When Louise had a lot of problems with Jambo, her staffy, who all of you probably know because he's all over Facebook, and he had to have major surgery. And when the surgery was over, the vet said to Louise, it's going to be really stressful because he's going to have to wear an e-collar. And Louise said, oh, I've got one here, no worries. Brought it out, and Jambo ran up to it, shoved his head in the e-collar, and the e-collar went on and off they went. And then the vet said several weeks later that she'd never seen a dog recover so quickly. And she was absolutely convinced that so much of that was because that post-operative scenario was not stressful for him. So that got Louise thinking, well, I've got to go research this and figure out if this actually is true. And sure enough, as Christina said, and it actually is actually why Louise developed that. She developed a course on this, how to get a positive conditioned emotional response to an e-collar, Elizabethan collar, because it's such an important component. And then the second thing I just wanted to mention quickly, the veterinarian that I was with who removed me from his office, he made a comment to me that I thought was very, very telling. In defense of the staff handling of my dog, I said, and I realized as soon as I said it, that it didn't make any sense to anybody. I blurted out, she's actually a really well-behaved dog. And he looked at me and said, that is not a well-behaved dog. And that for me said so much about his knowledge in terms of emotions and behavior, because they quantify an emotionally anxious or fearful dog with being a bad, not well-behaved dog, which I thought was very telling. And actually, and it really upset me, because I left there thinking, well, first of all, my dog's not an obedience trained dog, because that's not the sort of family pet I want. She's just a very lovely, well-rounded dog. But it sort of hurt me that a veterinarian potentially couldn't see an animal that was struggling and realize that the dog was struggling. So I think that there still needs to be a lot of discussion about animals and their emotions.
Definitely.
Yeah.
We're getting close to the end of our panel. I'm going to bring up a topic because I think this is an important one that I still see a lot of, and I would be interested on how the panel deals with it. You had mentioned Dr. Anderson, Nikki, and I'm presuming you mean Dr. R.K. Anderson.
Yes.
And he had a letter to vets that he allowed dog trainers to use back in the early 90s, talking about the importance of socialization and puppy kindergarten classes, and no, your dog doesn't have to have all of its vaccinations. And I keep thinking that here we are 30 some years later, even with many of the veterinary organizations having position statements on this. I think one of the things we could really help vets and our clients is, how do we get the veterinary world that doesn't understand this to understand this?
That's a $1 million question, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because we can create lots of really cool marketing and educational, but if you can't get through the door, if you can't engage them, if you can't talk to them, then it's all null and void, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And it's still, I mean, it happens much less than it did 20
it's
years ago.
It's definitely better.
Yeah. It's definitely better, but it's still, you know, I'm going to say once every 3 months I get someone, well, I didn't do a puppy class because my vet or the breeder, could be either one, told me not to do anything until they've had all of their vaccinations.
And it's not just the US, because my girlfriend in the UK, who I'm doing some virtual puppy classes with right now, I asked her, she signed up for a puppy class in the UK with a PPG member, and I asked her why she'd left it so long, and she said, my veterinarian told me not to take the dog outside around other dogs or people until it's 12 weeks old.
So if you guys think that's frustrating, Most veterinarians tell you not to take your cat out of the house at all.
Yeah. Ever.
Ever.
That's really funny, Beth, because Zazie Todd and I did a Facebook Live last week, and we were talking about the cultural differences between the UK and the US.
Yeah.
In the UK, if you don't let your cat outside, you'd be deemed a bad cat owner. In the US, if you let your cat outside, you're deemed a bad cat owner.
You know, and that's a whole different thing, because letting your cat outside, like opening the front door and saying, hey, Fluffy, see you in 2 hours, is probably not all that great an idea anyway. There is a happy medium. But the thing is, you know, cat socialization, I mean, there is kitten kindergarten, those classes mm-hmm. exist, there's yeah. good structured curriculums for that, and they've been validated, but nobody does them. Even vets who do puppy classes don't do kitten classes. And so this idea, I mean, I talked about this at, you know, at Geek Week last year, about this idea that, you know, put your cat in the carrier and go visit a friend of yours so that you let the cat out of the carrier, give them a meal, play with your friend and bring them home. Like nobody does that. When I suggest that to people, they think I'm nuts. Why would I take a cat to visit a friend? Why not? Why not? You know, so that when you go away, maybe your cat can stay at your friend's house. When you take the cat to the vet, maybe he's not freaking out. When you put him in the carrier, it doesn't 100% of the time predict a trip to the veterinarian. So if you guys are frustrated about puppy classes, boy, you should try it with kitten socialization.
Yeah, I hear you.
So we only have a few minutes left. So do we have time, Don, to just sort of get one tip from everybody so I can supplement this list and hopefully spin it into a great handout?
Sure. Who wants to go first?
Holden.
Thank you, Holden.
Go for it.
I'm going to push again for data collection, observations, right? Video, narrative, or, you know, somehow creating a framework that you can collect observations, especially over time and outside of the context of the veterinary office, so that you can present that information in a clear, concise way.
So the pet owner, if the pet owner has a pet and there's a concern, try and get videos so that when you go into the clinic and the animal's not showing its normal sort of topography of behavior, you can say, here you go, this is what I'm seeing at home.
I think at a minimum, yeah.
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 Good idea.
Yeah. And I would, you know, I would say, how many times a week are they vomiting? You know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. What's changed? How did they used to jump on the couch and now they don't jump on the couch? I mean, all of those things. And so I agree 100% with that, because I get clients all the time. They call me. It's like, the cat's vomiting. Well, how often? I don't know. Maybe once, maybe seven times. I don't know. It's like, there's a big difference between once and seven times. Mm-hmm. And you need to know that.
Well,
and how long?
How many pet owners actually observe their pet's poop? I mean, I check every poop my dog produces. I mean, I'm the sort of poop, let's patrol for poop. But a lot of pet owners don't, because they don't understand how relevant that is if there is a medical concern, that's really important. It's a question that vet's going to ask.
So I've got...
I've got one I'm going to add here. All day. I have photographs. I have galleries. I can talk about it all day.
One that I would add here, and I think this applies to both vets and to pet parents when they're communicating to anybody else in the circle. And that includes their trainer, it includes their boarding kennel, their daycare. If your pet has medical issues or behavioral issues, you need to disclose them. You cannot fail to disclose them, feeling if you don't mention it, you're not potentially causing a problem. You know, everybody, it doesn't help keeping those a secret. Everybody who deals with your pet needs to know about those things.
Yeah.
For me, it's have a clear list of questions you want to ask. Think about it beforehand. I do that when I go to the vet. I think beforehand, what do I want to tell them, Holden, as, you know, per yours, what do I want to tell them? And then what do I want to ask them? And I write it down and I pull my list out.
I think I would, mine would be just that we can and should do preparatory training. Especially if, you know, and I want to like stick this in there as a little tiny aside, is that we can advocate for breeders to produce dogs who are friendly to strangers and friendly and comfortable being handled. And that would be good for vets too. But if we, you know, we have the dog in front of us. So doing preparatory training as with puppies or training with adult dogs who maybe already have fears or don't, I mean, get it early, why not? And is something that we can do as trainers that would help dogs and help vets.
Thank you.
I would say positive reinforcement for the vet and the staff and the animal. So bringing food, lots of food. I think we had my dog ate an entire chicken breast at his, or at least.
I thought you were going to say an entire chicken. I thought that's about right.
Yeah, it was a lot. And he got a very thorough exam because he went in for snapping. So it was like very non-specific. So we were there for like almost an hour, but because my vet is phenomenal. But positive reinforcement of the clinic and the staff, if they do something that you like, make sure they know that you do something or that they did something that you like, which is good for them, but will also help you because then it's more likely to happen again.
Yeah.
And then I already said, you know, bringing food for your animal. Good, you know, if you have a vet that is concerned about these things, they'll have it too, but maybe your animal doesn't want those things.
But nobody wants to be that customer that walks through the door and the front desk or staff sort of go, oh God, there they are. Yeah, because I mean, sugar works, doesn't it? I mean, the nicer you are to people, the kinder you are. Unless you're dealing with that one-off, really unreasonable individual, you're going to get better service just by showing kindness. That's how I try and get through life anyway. Doesn't always work, but we try.
Anyone else have something to add to Nikki's list?
No, I went to my vets to offer training for their clients that they knew that they were having the most problems with. So I told them, you know, we could do a class at their veterinary office if they want, and I would do it for free for them. I had a couple that took me up on that. And so I worked with the owners during that class to teach them how to work with their animals, cats getting in carriers, you know, explaining and showing and demonstrating how to bring the dog or puppy in and maybe just come in, weigh them, let the, you know, somebody on staff give treats and do what they call like happy visits. And, you know, I had a couple of them, you know, a couple of vets offices that took me up on it, and it helped them out. It helped the owners out. It helped the animals out.
Just thought of another one. This is a pet peeve that vets often don't understand, nor do our clients. And that is teaching your dog to sit down and walk politely on a leash does not necessarily resolve emotional behavioral issues.
Well, that was exactly what I was saying, that there's an assumption that if your dog will sit down and stay, that they're, that they're a good dog. Yeah.
And it probably gets back to the fact that we still have a lot of vets out there who really, as well as human clients, that don't understand dogs and cats have a full emotional life.
Yeah. And I think as well, I mean, in those sort of environments, I wouldn't be asking my dog to do anything other than just to try and be as comfortable as possible. I certainly wouldn't be trying to, you know, cue them into a sit or a down. I mean, that's quite controlling, isn't it? Even though they might do it because they get reinforced for it, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they feel good about doing it.
Anyone else?
Sam, give me the last one because I'm almost out of paper. What you got, Sam? You started this. What you got? Close us out.
Fine. If people, Don, you brought this up at the beginning, communicate. I have a couple of the clients that I work with. I tell them when it comes to vet appointments, ask for either that first one of the day or the last one at night. Mm-hmm. Because you know what?
Yeah, it helps
give the staff and the vet and the dog and their guardian a chance to know that it's going to be less stressful than trying to sit in a crowded waiting room or waiting in the car, you know, that kind of a thing. And this just kind of bogs my mind with veterinarians. I tell people, do not be afraid to take a, I don't know, a mat or something for when your dog has to be on that cold exam table and they're slipping and sliding, which is just adding to their stress because they're not able to maintain a posture, right? To put that down and be part of it, you know?
Yeah.
I'll help, you know, hold my dog in a way that dog's going to feel comfortable because it's me. Mm-hmm. But asking that for that first or last appointment of the day makes huge difference for so many of the dogs that I work with have behavioral issues.
Right.
And the vets are very appreciative of it. You know, they know what's coming, they can prepare for it, and they don't have to worry about how it's affecting the rest of their day, the clients, et cetera.
Yeah. And you know, often when you get to a vet clinic, there's a backlog.
Yes.
I mean, you got to be patient because a vet is going to deal with an emergency. It doesn't matter how many appointments they've got. I mean, and we would expect the vets to do the same for us if we rushed in with our dog who was in an emergency situation. So I think going for that first appointment, you're not going to fall behind. You're not going to have to wait extended periods of time because of an emergency, are you, if you get the first appointment? So, yeah. Excellent.
Great, okay. Less stress.
Christina, I can see your brain's working. Anything you got for us? She's looking really serious now.
No, I don't think I have anything more to add than what everyone has already said. It's been a good discussion.
Fabulous. Okay.
Okay, everyone. Well, listeners, thank you for tuning in, or I guess that's not the exact right word or phrase, but thank you for joining us. And panel, thanks again for a wonderful discussion. We appreciate your spending your time here with us every month. So until next week or next month, folks, we'll see you again.
Everyone's face is like, what? We're back next week.
Yeah, I said that and then I panicked myself. So next month.
Have a great weekend, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.